Welcome to the Inspiration 316 show hosted by John Beaner, founder of Wise Counsel. John shares the inspiring and shocking miracles of how Jesus Christ is changing lives, families, organizations, and nations in this chaotic world. These are the true stories the media won't cover because they defy the shocking bad news they are selling. Stay tuned to be inspired.
Well, good day. It's John Beaner. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Inspiration 316. Hey, I'm very excited today. We've got our special guest with us. Jay Haig has come to be with us. He believes in inspiring people with his story and testimony. He's an amazing guy because he was raised in a perfect home. We'll find out about that later. Okay, and he also, what happened, became an Anglican priest and decided to leave that and became a financial planner, if I understand that. Had his own radio show for many years. And then God took him through a tough time in his life. And it had to do with lust. You know, can you believe that? And men have lust. Well, women have lust too, right? But it's a desire for something greater, and it's something we can be addicted to, just like anything else. And so the book that he wrote, which is how, when did your book come out, Jay? How long ago?
I think it was about 3 or 4 years ago.
Okay. The title is The Rest of God. I love that. That's a great title. Finding Freedom from Lust in an Internet Age. Okay, well, thank you, Jay, for being with us. It's excited to have you here today.
Thank you, John. It's a privilege and a joy. You and I have crossed paths over the years, but
yeah,
this opportunity has given us a chance to deepen our connection, and I'm grateful for that.
Me too. I'm excited. Yeah, and Jay's also agreed to speak at our Strongman Conference. It's going to be on April 13th with Crosswinds Leadership. And we've also got Brighart committed for that event. We've got Matt Kirk, a local pastor, and also Harry Lewis, who's involved with Austin Manhood, which is a course, and one of the co-owners of Lewis Petroleum. So excited to have you, Jay, as a part of that team as well. That'll be a fun event out at the Blueberry Farm. You don't want to miss that, folks, at the Blueberry Farm. For men, it's called the Strongman Leadership Conference.
And we'll be able to get into some of the deeper issues. You and I will talk today about some of those, but we'll get into deeper issues at the conference as well. I'm looking forward to connecting with the men there.
Okay, well, great, great. Now, tell us a little bit about your background. Were you where were you born and raised and that kind of thing? Huh?
Well, I was born and raised in a town northeast of Boston called Marblehead. It's a story that George Whitefield, the great evangelist, came through Marblehead, as he did all of his preaching around the 13 colonies, remember, around 1740. And apparently he came to Marblehead, and he shook his head as he left the town on his horse, and he said, "Marblehead, marble hearts." So apparently the people of Marblehead is also a Revolutionary War thing about being tarred and feathered by the women of Marblehead. So this is an old, historic, small town northeast of Boston, and I was raised there. My parents were Ivy League educated people. My mother was president of her class at Wellesley College for 3 years. My father went to Penn, and they were good people. But I did have, in my growing up years, that my parents had a little bit of carried shame. My father was beaten up and teased and had his bicycle stolen and all kinds of things when he was a kid.
Hmm.
And as a result of that, he kind of pulled inward, and it was always kind of looking inside and not available emotionally to the family. Good man, very gentle man, great provider, good father in many ways. But and then my mother was adopted, and I think she had some shame about that. And so I kind of lived in that shame. So good environment, but you know, people can get tied up in things. And the older I get, John, the more I realize that a lot of us, as we age, are still trying to come to terms with the things that happened to us as kids.
Yeah,
that cause this kind of pain, and we know that addiction can be formed in some of that emotional and spiritual turmoil of the early childhood years.
Yeah. Well, we all have a body, soul, and a spirit, right? And so the soul, the mind, intellect, personality, will, and emotion gets caught up in memories a lot of times that are, some of it's garbage, right? And obviously you talked about shame, condemnation, unfulfillment, sorrow, bitterness, resentment, unforgiveness, all those kind of good things.
Yeah.
Bad things, I better put put it correctly anyway.
Yeah. And I had two experiences which shaped my life. One was I was physically abused at a camp when I was 8 years old, and then I was sexually abused at a camp when I was 11. And those two experiences gave me two of the fundamental lies that I have lived with for a good part of my life. And the first lie was that I'm all alone and there's no one to help me. Okay. And the second lie was that sex was my most important need. So if you combine those two together, you get someone who's isolated, secretive, believing they have to go it on their own. And I actually, when I remembered some of these experiences, I saw the Lord standing at the bottom of my bunk at one of those camps, telling me that he was not going to let anything worse happen to me. And that, in fact, happened. He protected me. But those foundational lies that, unfortunately, we build these little protective covers over, thinking that no one can reach them or God can't reach them, are the ways that addiction can come out, somehow build itself into our lives. And that's why we need ministry, we need honesty, we need fellowship, and we need treatment and support in the context of the church. And that's what my organization, Living Without Lust, does. You can go to our website, by the way, livingwithoutlust.com, and see all of our information there, our resources. And if you want to be in touch with us, you can sign up for our e-newsletter. But we do a lot of work with churches and pastors and leaders, which I can get into at a later time.
Great. Yeah, that's very good. It's exciting. Again, exciting to have you here. Again, I'm here with Jay Haig, and he's written a book called The Rest of God. That's going to be good for us to talk about that and how you got into writing this book. So you're saying that growing up as a kid, you were at 8 years old, you were physically molested. Is that what you said it was? How did you describe that? Okay, that was beat up? Is that what that meant? Or what?
Yes. What happened was I went to camp. It was an Episcopal camp. And by the way, I was an Episcopal priest years ago.
Right.
Ended up leaving that. Okay. But this guy was, he carried a clipboard and a whistle, and he was going to keep everyone under control. So he said, if you're even 30 seconds late for the gathering together of the people to go down to the dining hall, you will be punished and you will go through what he called the industrial strength hot oven, which was you ran backwards and everybody slapped your rear end, and you went through a gauntlet of 150 kids. I was 8 years old.
Wow.
And actually the physical thing didn't really hurt me that much. What hurt me was I fell down in the dust and everybody left me there and walked to the chapel and then of course said a prayer grace for dinner. And I was left in that shame of being alone, punished, and abandoned.
Wow. I could see how that would really have a big impact, particularly at 8 years old. I mean, my gosh.
Yeah.
There was no grace of God in that environment. An Episcopal priest that did this?
No. He was he was a camp counselor, and he was a tough guy.
Okay.
And I always remember that he was from a certain town in Massachusetts. And whenever that town was mentioned, I would get this pit in my stomach as I remembered him and I remembered that experience. You know, Alexander Lowen wrote a book called The Body. And in that book, he says that every single experience we have, our body records. It's like a tape recorder.
Sure.
We can deny it, but the emotions and the feelings connected with that experience remain until we somehow deal with it, acknowledge it, let it go, forgive, get rid of our resentment, whatever it may be. So that stuff stays with us until we come to terms with it.
Mm, wow. Wow, that's very good. We need inner healing, obviously, then, to remove the scar. The scar is still going to be a memory that'll be there, but the condemnation about it all, the guilt about it all, needs to be removed because God can do that. You know?
Right.
There is no condemnation in Christ Jesus.
So. Yes. One of the things that we do is this transformational prayer ministry, which is replaces the lie, and those two things I said were lies. Mm-hmm. I was not alone, and sex was not my most important need, but I needed to replace those with the truth. So we remember the emotional experience, and we go back to it, and we allow Jesus to come in, and then he speaks the truth.
Amen.
He speaks the truth into the situation. When the truth comes in, the lie has to depart, and the truth is he was with me, and sex is a part of my life, but it is not my most important need. And I don't need to lust in order to have that fulfillment sexually, obviously, with my wife.
Right. That's amazing. Now, so at 11, you were sexually abused. That's a different story then,
yes.
Obviously.
And this is rather an unbelievable story. When we talk about dangerous places for kids, overnight camps, choirs, boys' choirs are really a source of sexual abuse. I know many people that have been abused in boys' choirs.
Really?
Yes. And in this camp, it was a camp we were touring New England, going to various hotels and churches and various places singing. We were actually paid. But the camp counselor put all the kids in a cabin without any adults.
Okay.
So it seems incredible that anyone would do that. But this was this is 1962.
Okay.
And unfortunately, some of the boys were a little older, and they were sexually experimenting with each other. And I was exposed to that. I didn't really know what it was, but I was 11 years old. I had not reached puberty. But it seemed very exciting and very important. That was very much put into my mind at that time. So when I did reach puberty later on, I thought, oh, this is what they're talking about now.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I fueled a lot of that during my teenage years with pornography and masturbation.
Okay. That's two monumental experiences in your life that sort of put an imprint on your life as you went along. So anyway, you graduated from school in Massachusetts?
I actually went to prep school in New Hampshire, Holderness School. That's how I got to Jacksonville, because the chaplain at the school was my track coach. We used to come down here to Jacksonville and to run and train for the spring track season. He was a very good coach. And so I graduated from there, went to Williams College in Massachusetts, which is, if you look at U.S. News and World Report, it's the number one rated liberal arts college in the country now. I'm not sure I could get into it now, but I went there and then went to seminary in England for a couple of years. I was part of the evangelical movement within the Episcopal Church, the more conservative, biblically based. So I went to England to do my Bible, then came back to Virginia Seminary, and then finished up there. I got my Master of Divinity and then went off to my first church in Massachusetts.
So what was your degree at Williams College, anyway?
American Civilization.
How about
and,
that?
Of course, when I went to England, they said, you majored in American Civilization. They said, isn't that an oxymoron?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my major. That was a great preparation for ministry, by the way, a great preparation, because we dealt with everything, all the movements within America, all the, you know, art, architecture, music, literature, history, all of that. And it's a great preparation for anybody going into ministry.
Okay. So what was it that caused you to go into the ministry? Because it doesn't sound like that course of study would draw you, but I mean, was God moving on your heart or something?
What was it? I became a Christian when I was 18. I was brought up in the Episcopal Church, but my parents, they were believers, but we never had a vital personal relationship with Christ.
Right.
So I got exposed when I came down here to Young Life and to various other Christian movements.
Okay.
And where people talked about Jesus, they talked about the Bible. And I knew that after I came back to New Hampshire that something had happened to me. I didn't know quite what. But when
you're saying you came down for this track coach time or track time where you're down here in a warmer climate to prepare for the track season up northeast. And so you got experience Young Life during that time.
Yes. And when I went to college, there was an assistant at the local church who was an evangelical guy, and he was very instrumental in inviting us into his apartment, and we had Bible studies and so on. And finally, I gave my life to Christ. And then about a year later, I went to the Urbana Missionary Conference out in Champaign-Urbana, University of Illinois. It's a gathering where there's 13,000 students.
Really?
And at that
now, what year would that been?
1970.
Okay.
So at the end of that conference, we heard all kinds of people speak. Leighton Ford, John Stott, Tom Skinner, who was a black inner-city black pastor. They called for people to go into the mission field. And I didn't stand up for that, but at the end they said, call to full-time Christian service and ministry, and I stood for that.
Wow.
And John Stott, who's a very famous English evangelical, said, we're looking for Christian communicators today, and I said, that's me. So I stood up. So at that point, I was really set to go into the ministry, and I was preparing to do that, leading youth groups and so on, and got involved in another group called the Fellowship of Christians in Universities and Schools in New England, and got a lot of guidance and then went off to seminary.
Okay. So you felt God drawing you into the seminary to...
Yes.
To become a priest or...
Yes,
to
become Episcopal priest. There was an emerging movement within the Episcopal Church of young, educated evangelical clergy who were going to... We were going to change the course of the Episcopal Church. We're going to make it more biblical. We're going to make it more evangelistic. We're going to make it more personal in our faith. And like a lot of young people, we go in thinking we're going to change the world.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that sounds like an exciting journey, really.
It was very exciting. It was a great time. All the time, though, this stuff inside was still there.
Still perking, yeah.
Yeah, I was still going to... the peep shows and porn things and so on. And I had a great tendency to compartmentalize my life. I could just push that aside.
Yeah, right.
Say, this is what I need to do, but then I'll get back to my regular stuff.
Right.
And I thought, of course, that my marriage would cure me. So I met the most beautiful woman I've ever seen, my wife, and I thought, well, she'll cure me. She'll fix me. And what I didn't realize, and this is a big problem today, is that marriage doesn't fix lust.
Uh-huh.
Only Jesus can deal with lust.
Praise
so God. So I lived under that illusion for many, many years and tried, and my wife acknowledged it to her, and then we sought counseling. We got a lot of very bad counseling when it comes to this. And
typical. More what you call worldly counsel, even though they call it Christian. Is that what you mean?
Well, it's from all various people called it kid stuff. They said my wife needed to dress up like a porn star. They said that it would go away. That we said we got advice that it was okay to look at porn, but they didn't want us to feel guilty about it. Let's get rid of the guilt without getting rid of the behavior.
Okay.
So a lot of bad advice because, frankly, lust is an issue that people don't know how to deal with, don't know how to talk about. It's sort of like a time bomb or an explosive. It's like having a hand grenade with the pin pulled sitting in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
And pastors are afraid and people are afraid because, John, we're like Victorians now. We're not like biblical Christians. We're like Victorians. Our message to people is don't do it. And let's not talk about it. And that is failing dramatically because we're seeing a huge rise in this problem of lust, pornography, and sexual addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And it's time for the church to respond to it. But we exist, Living Without Lust exists to provide the tools, to find the. We are a referral, we are an educational and a resource organization. We connect people, we help people, we provide resources to pastors who... because their pastors are on the front line. They get the first call. They get the first, when somebody's resigned from work because they looked at porn or they had an affair, they get the first call. And we want to stand behind them to help them facilitate, give resources, and help to those that struggle.
Okay. That's good. Very good. So let's go back to some of your history again. So you went to seminary was it in London or where was it in England?
In Nottingham, England. It was right in the middle in the Midlands. And the reason I looked at Nottingham and Oxford was old, crusty, and dusty Oxford.
Yeah.
And Nottingham was this new up-and-coming seminary. They did radio and TV. They had the oldest faculty member was 44.
Okay.
So it was
okay.
A lot of young, exciting things going on. And I said, I'm going to go there. Mm-hmm. So I spent 2 years there from 1973 to 1975.
Okay. So that you got... graduated then and came to the States to become a priest then?
Yes. I went to Virginia Seminary for... I was single at the time. Normally you would go 3 years, but Virginia would not give you the master's degree in one year. In other words, some people went 2 years in England, then 1 year here, but they didn't go away with a degree. So I was single. I thought, I'm going to stay for the second year and get the degree. So I actually had 4 years of seminary instead of three.
Okay. How about that? So how did what you learned at Young Life tie together with the seminary?
Well, there was a movement, a big movement in England, and a significant but smaller movement at Virginia Seminary of people that were in fellowship. They were evangelicals. They had an active prayer life. They sought the Lord's will for their lives. They were hoping to serve Him in churches and to help them either grow or change. So there was always this cadre of people that kind of fellowship together, and there were a few on the faculty as well. One of them eventually left and started a new evangelical seminary in Pittsburgh, but there was always that group of people who gathered together and sought the Lord and His purpose in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what do you think was the most significant thing you learned from the seminary experience in the 4 years?
Well, I think for me it was that that the Christian faith study, the studying of the Word, the studying of theology, the studying of practical pastoral theology, how it applies to people's lives, is a lifelong endeavor. Uh-huh. You're not going to learn everything you need to learn. Seminary is an academic exercise. You come away with book learning. You study theologians. You study the history of the church, etc. But as you interact with people, you realize there are certain things that are drawing you, or there are certain problems that people are facing that need to be addressed. And that's why clergy need to have ongoing continuing education. They need to have sabbaticals. They need to respond. And many people go on to get doctors of ministry degrees and various things because they want to focus on certain areas, whether it be church growth or pastoral theology, whatever it might be. So I think I came away realizing that my study is going to be lifelong, and I've actually probably read 3 times the number of books I read in seminary since leaving seminary.
Okay. So then, anyway, you got started as a Episcopal priest, and so where'd you start? How'd you?
I started in a little town called Auburn, Massachusetts. It was a blue collar, the first town you escaped if you left for the suburbs from Worcester, Massachusetts.
Okay.
People lived in triple deckers in Worcester, Massachusetts. So if your first house, the most affordable house is probably in Auburn, Massachusetts, right in the middle of the state. I was in a church that had been a mission church for 47 years, which meant that it didn't have enough money to be self-supporting.
Okay.
So I came in, and within 2 years, we became an independent parish for the first time. A lot of people came in. A lot of new and different people came in. We had African-American people who came in, and that was a little bit of a controversy. But a lot more young people came in, and the church became an independent parish. We started Bible study groups. We had missions. We had revival meetings. We had all kinds of stuff. In every church that I've been in, I've always wanted to connect people in the church with outside people who could bring another perspective. So I invited all kinds of people to speak. I invited people from the Canadian Revival Fellowship. I invited Father Diorio, the great Catholic healing priest, to come. I invited some of my friends from other relationships in other areas of the country to come in and preach. So that was a really good time, but it was an exhausting time. And after 5 years, I took a sabbatical and came down here. And that's eventually how I got down here, was I came down on sabbatical. For the bishop allowed me to go for 4 months, 3 month sabbatical plus month vacation. Came down to All Souls Episcopal in Mandarin, and hooked up with them for about 2 months. And when we left, they contacted us and said, you know, we want you to come down, and we're starting mission churches, so we want you to start the next mission. So I put that in my mind. My wife and I eventually left Massachusetts, moved to Pennsylvania, to Lancaster, where she's from. I was a runner then. I was trying to qualify for the Olympic trials and the marathon.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So I spent 15 months doing that in Pennsylvania. I kind of got sick and got worn down physically.
Okay.
But eventually landed here in 1984. So I was 5 years in Massachusetts, a year and a half in a church. That's a story in itself.
Yeah.
Because we left Massachusetts, moved to Pennsylvania without a job. My parents were shocked. My dad did not understand. Hmm. We walked into a church, and the pastor said, I'm looking for you. So what do you mean? He said, I've been looking for somebody like you. Would you be willing to work 2/3 time here? I said, that's perfect. I can train for the marathon. I can run races and do what I do. And then so we had a really great time there for about 15 months, and then eventually came to Florida.
And what city was that again?
Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
The Amish country.
Yes, right. That's a
beautiful place.
It is beautiful.
If you've never gone to Lancaster, you need to go, listeners. Yeah. It's a great, great place.
Yeah, we lived in Columbia, Maryland for 5 years, so we'd go up to Lancaster and go to the farms or the farmers markets up there, particularly in York, Pennsylvania. Never forget that experience. But we loved it. In fact, I started a business in Columbia called Farmer John's Market as an inspiration from that. You know,
very cool.
I wasn't in the seminary, obviously, at the time, but it's not. Yeah, that's a beautiful place to be in Lancaster. There's a major ministry out of there too. I'm trying to think of the name. We've had the guy who's the founder of that speak down here, and they do the raising of capital for the small businesses starting around the world. What do we call that? Seed capital, but there's another term for it. Exciting stuff going on in Lancaster. It's a beautiful area.
It is.
Yeah. So then you came back down here. We're going to have to take a break here in just a second, but let's tell the listeners anyway that you came to Jacksonville then. What was it, 1984?
84.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. And I was with Whitey Hogan at All Souls, and that was really, I think, the heyday of All Souls before, you know, the big controversy in the late 90s, early 2000s. But the church grew. We had 20 prayer groups, you know, home fellowship groups going on there. It was a great opportunity for us to kind of relax a little bit because I was the associate rector there. Great time.
That's great. All right. This is John Beaner with Inspiration 316. I'm here with Jay Haig. Fabulous interview. You don't want to miss this. We're going to take a quick break. Mary, Did You Know? Penix is singing that. We'll be back here in a moment.
Did you know that your baby boy has come to make you new? This child that you delivered will soon deliver you.
If you're on I-295 on the west side, southbound near Normandy Boulevard, there's an accident. I-10 west at mile marker 348, there's a broken down car. And I-95 north, it's slow from Emerson to across the Fullerton Bridge. It is partly cloudy this evening with an overnight low of 43 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, but not as warm. Our high tomorrow, 64.
Mary, did you know that your baby boy would one day walk on water? Mary, did you know that your baby boy would save our sons and daughters? Did you know that your baby...
Welcome back. This is John Beaner. You're listening to Inspiration 316. Thanks for joining us. I'm here with Jay Haig, who is the founder of Living Without Lust. He has been an Episcopal priest. He's been a radio show host. He's been a financial planner. This guy knows a lot. He's intelligent. He's good looking. He's smart. You know, God has great favor over him, and he's broken free from the issues of the lust issues that the enemy tries to put against him and keep him bound up into, because he had horrendous experiences in the early part of his life that put an imprint on his soul and his heart that create a desire for those activities. And we'll talk more about that, Jay. But anyway, back in 1984, so you came on board with Whitey Hogan at All Souls Episcopal Church. I remember that because I probably came as a guest during that year, because I came to Christ in 1980, and then I remember taking my family to that church, and we lived not very far away from it. And so, but I did not get a family, yahoo, let's do this. And so I was blocked from having that happen. But I loved Whitey Hogan. I thought he was a very outstanding guy. So
he really is. He really was a sacrificial presence in my life. Even when I got to college, I used to go down and visit him because he left to go to another prep school in Connecticut. And those were great years. And he's still around. He's still thriving. He's still leading a Bible study in his mid-80s.
Really? No kidding. That's great. So what? How long then were you with the All Souls Church and all?
I was with them 5.5 years. As I mentioned, All Souls was sending out missions. So we planted a mission down in Julington Creek. It was a little bit premature because the real estate market in the 80s was booming, and then all of a sudden it stopped. That's the way things tend to go, as you know.
Right.
So The church was down there, and it had some issues. So then the next time was about 5 years later. So we planted a church out in San Pablo Road. We named it Calvary, okay. Partly after Sam Shoemaker. Sam Shoemaker, okay. You may recognize that name, was sure. One of the guys who helped found AA.
Yes.
At Calvary Church in New York City, Calvary Church in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And so we decided to call it that. And we had a mission group, and we opened the church. First door service, we had 200 people there. So we were very gratified about that. And I was there for until 1993 when I resigned. And I came forward to my wife, and I told her that I'd been unfaithful to her.
Okay.
And then I went to counseling, went to treatment down at something that doesn't exist anymore, the Christian Care Center in Clearwater. And that's when I really began to understand what sexual addiction was. I watched 18 tapes by a guy named Patrick Carnes, who's kind of the father of the sexual addiction treatment movement, and began to understand. And then, of course, I had to confess more stuff to her, and that led to our separation. And had some powerful experiences with God. I remember driving down to the Christian Care Center, and I was in these waves of grief and weeping. And in the midst of that, this voice came to me and said in very clear terms, everything is going to be okay.
Hmm. Praise God.
And so when you compare the voice, the word, to the circumstances, you have two very different things. My life's totally falling apart. And yet the word comes, everything's going to be okay, and I believe the word.
Amen.
The second experience came when I was came back. I moved in someone else's house with a couple. They took care of me for a while. I was looking for work. I was going into secular work. And I remember going down to the local printing shop, and I put in a big order. It was stationery. It was business cards, resumes. And I went, and I did not know this man. And I didn't know that he knew me. But I walked up, and he pushed this big box of stuff, well over $50 worth of printing material. And I said, what do I owe you? And he said, nothing. I said, what do you mean nothing? Why nothing? He said, because I believe in you.
Wow.
And sometimes that's what we need. We need another human being say, mm-hmm. I haven't given up on you. I believe in you. I'm going to invest in you. I'm going to walk with you. And those powerful experiences helped to propel me into my career, which was as a financial advisor.
Really? Wow. So you went to work for a financial institution?
I did.
Or you actually?
I went to work for a big brokerage house.
Okay.
One of the best on Wall Street, and I had a wonderful career there for nearly 20 years. I worked for two different companies.
Okay.
And I worked there almost until I retired.
Okay. All right, so that's amazing, 20 years at that. Now, that's when you had your radio show, too, right?
Yeah, I had the radio show toward the end of that. But I have to tell you, John, that I always sipped at lust through this whole process. I never quite gave it up. Months would go by. My wife would go out of town. I'd buy a porn DVD, masturbate. I could not get away from the lust permanently. I had to, it's like an alcoholic who says, I may not be drinking 10 bourbons a day, but I got to sip a little bit, you know? Uh-huh. And as long as that element remains in the system, you're still an alcoholic.
Yeah.
Lust is the same way. As long as that is in your system, mm-hmm. there is a real danger that your recovery and your life can be put at risk. Mm-hmm. So though I never betrayed my wife again, I still sipped at lust as time went on.
But you did, you and your wife got back together again, right?
We reconciled after 10 months. The thing, John, that's so important is when my wife and I got back, she had a lot of strength. And she said, look, if we're going to get back together, this is going to be on different terms. The old marriage is dead. Mm-hmm. I once heard a thing from NPR where a woman said, you're going to have most people have three marriages in the course of their life. And sometimes the three marriages will all be with the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So the old marriage had to die, and the new marriage had to come forth in a new way. And that's what we built our recovery and our restoration on. So after 10 months, we got back together and began to work on that.
Praise God. That's good. Mm. Great testimony for her, too, to tell that story, right?
Yes. A lot of pain for her. A lot of stuff that she had to come to terms with, and we're still working on it, John. I'm not completely lust-free in the sense that God has shown me that this is a lifelong thing, and that it's part of my, it's like Paul's thorn in the flesh, you know, the thing, whatever it was, he said, he asked the Lord to take it away three times, and the Lord didn't take it away. He said, my grace is sufficient for you. His grace is sufficient for me. So that I have to be dependent on him. I have to work a program. And that weakness, that congenital weakness, this is part of my life, makes me more dependent on him and more able to help other people. Because I think that is why he has allowed this to continue. He says, because it's not all about you. It's about my reaching the world. And the best person to talk about a person that struggles with lust is another person that struggles with lust. We know that, don't we?
Yeah, you know, that's the kind of the thorn, you might say, that Paul had, okay? It keeps drawing you closer to God, or keep being dependent upon God, you know, to be whole or to be healed or to be feel set free, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Even though it may not be totally set free, God has a plan to use it.
Right.
And use it for your purpose or his purpose.
Yeah. And I have to choose every day to walk that walk. And this is controversial in the Christian community because a lot of people think you should say, be able to say a prayer, get delivered, and then you have no more problems. But that's not the experience of addiction. The experience of addiction is it's a day at a time. It's a decision at a time. You do everything in your program to stay healthy and whole. Whatever works. We say there's four building blocks. There's treatment. There's individual therapy. There's 12-step groups where you get in a room with other people that struggle as we do. And we help each other. And then the last stage is you have a supportive Christian pastor or friend who will simply pray with you, stay with you, walk with you through this so you know you're not alone.
So lust is a big issue for men. I mean, is there any man out there that hasn't lusted? Tell us more about what does that lust actually mean and how does it?
Well, it's a lot of people think that lust is simply something that you can feel for anybody, including your wife. But lust is very different. Lust is objectifying another human being for your own private pleasure. So it can be several looks at a female jogger going down the road, or a woman in a bikini at the beach, or it can be something online. But lust and love are opposite to each other.
Okay.
But when Pope John Paul came here in the 1980s, the Washington Post editorial writer said, the Pope doesn't understand lust. He doesn't understand that if you lust after your wife, you won't lust after anyone else. That's a misunderstanding. It's a misunderstanding. Lust is self-centered, and it is never satisfied and cannot be controlled. That's the key thing to understand. That's why Jesus said, Matthew 5, 27 to 28, if a man lusts after another woman, he didn't say another woman other than his wife. A woman in his heart, he's already committed adultery with her in his heart. Mm. It's a heart problem. It's a desire to control and manipulate other people. So sexual desire and lust are not the same thing. They are very distinct. And what we have to do is surrender lust and allow our true, loving, giving sexuality to come out in a relationship with our spouse, with our partner. And that's the fulfillment that we're really looking for. The lust is a misconnection. It's even a misconnection with God, because we often say, Lord, help me to find in that person, whether it's same-sex or opposite-sex attraction, help me to find in you what I'm looking for in that person when it comes to lust. Mm-hmm. So lust cannot be controlled. It can only be surrendered, and that takes support. It takes a program. And there's various, you know, there's various encounters with lust. We say there's four different people. Those that have never struggled, that's an extremely strong group. I've only met two people in 25 years who said they never struggled with it.
Yeah, right.
Then there's what we call the used to have a problem. The people that say, I used to look at porn, many of those are not really being honest with themselves because there's still an ongoing issue there.
Uh-huh.
The third group is what we call the casual luster. The casual luster can look at porn every once in a while, or can lust after a person in a social situation. Doesn't seem to affect them. They don't go downhill. They don't have increasing involvement or go to a lower environment. They don't go to prostitution or they're not looking at porn 5 hours a day, that the casual luster is always in danger of slipping into that next addictive category. And then there's the addict, and the addict has taken himself or herself out of the whole context of what is right and wrong. You can't tell the addict, don't do this, because it's like Paul says, the law came in to increase the trespass. Mm-hmm. There is just that adversarial relationship with the law in the heart that says, I can't control this, and often they will get into deeper and deeper involvement in this, and those are the folks that need real help, real intervention. They need treatment, 12-step. They need all kinds of help. They need a therapist and a long-term program in order to stay sober.
Mm-hmm. Stay sober. I mean, be free from or yes. Stay away
let's
from.
Let's define sobriety. For us, we have a certain definition of sobriety, and that is no sex with self and with anyone other than a spouse. So no masturbation. Mm-hmm. Often okay. For us, that'll include no porn. Uh-huh. Because porn and masturbation are so tied together. Uh-huh. So that's our definition of sobriety. But then there's a deeper surrender of lust. You can be sober for years. I've been sober since July 11th, 2010. So I'll be 8 years in July. I never thought I could ever give this up. I thought I was going to take it to the grave. Uh-huh. When I used to go into the XXX movie houses, it was filled with old men, mm-hmm. old white-haired men. I thought, what are these old white-haired men doing here? The lesson was, it's not cured by time. It's a spiritual disease that has a spiritual solution, and that's what we're here to help with.
Mm-hmm. Really a conviction to abstain, right?
It has to be conviction, but it has to be surrender, because many people,
right.
I would include myself, said, I shouldn't be doing this. I don't want to do this. That's not the issue. The issue is, are you willing to surrender to God, surrender to Jesus, and go into a program of recovery that is going to involve your working this program for the rest of your life? That is the real key. It's not good intentions. It's not moral rearmament. It's not, feeling terrible about it. It is a change of attitude which results in action. The early AAs said, right action leads to right thinking, not right thinking to right action. Mm-hmm. So you take the right action and do these things in the program, and suddenly your spirit and your heart and your mind begin to change.
All right, this is John Beener. You're listening to Inspiration 316. I'm here with Jay Haig, who's written the book The Rest of God, which is a powerful book, but also he has a ministry, Living Without Lust. And Jay, how do people reach you again?
They can go on the website, livingwithoutlust.com. They can contact me through the website, or you can send me an email at j@livingwithoutlust.com. We have men's retreats. We just had one a couple weeks ago. We help pastors. We have training sessions for Christian leaders. We do all kinds of stuff. But there's books, tapes, resources, and all kinds of things that you can get involved with. And the book really is about the Epistle to the Hebrews and my story. The Epistle to the Hebrews is the lust solution, gospel solution, answer in the New Testament, and that's why I chose to write it on Hebrews. I'm writing another one, by the way, on perfectionism, judgment, and comparison, which is another driver of addiction, and we have to come to terms with that as well.
Oh, amazing. How many men actually, and I don't know if there are statistics on this, but who are caught up in, let's say, pornography, but also then become adulterers, in other words, unfaithful to their spouse. Do you know any of those kind of statistics?
Well, here's the statistics. The Barna Research, which is everybody knows is the Christian Gallup.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah.
They have done the research. I'll just give you a couple of statistics. 20% of youth pastors are addicted to porn. Okay. So if you have a gathering of 100 youth pastors, 20 of them are addicted, and another 30% are struggling.
Okay.
The most frequent conversation that a youth minister, a friend of mine working in Tallahassee at Florida State, he says, that's the most frequent conversation with young college students is about porn. It's not about evangelism or church growth or discipleship. It's about porn use.
Yeah.
Our best statistics say that 30% of men in any given church are addicted and 50% are struggling.
Okay.
So it's very hard. Unless
that's with pornography.
That's with pornography, yeah. Or lust issues. Believe it or not, there are some people that have lust issues that don't look at porn. They do other things, usually more dangerous things. But porn and lust are very, very, it's 98% is the correlation between those two things, because it's so accessible. So, and the one of the big statistics that's happening now is of women age 18 to 31, 67% of them are looking at porn. Same age, 18.
Porn meaning pictures of men?
Unclothed, it could be anything. Could be men, could be women, could be situations on the internet, things that would be categorized as porn.
Okay.
Only slightly less than the men of 18 to 31, the millennials. Mm-hmm. I guess those millennials or Gen X. I don't know. Millennials, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And for women, it goes way down middle age. Men, it doesn't. You're 50 to 68, you're still about 50% of men are looking at porn a couple times a month anyway. So it is a huge problem, and it's bubbling to the surface with this whole Me Too movement and the sexual harassment of the thing. Because for the first time, we have a generation who are actually in the workforce who've had lived their entire lives with digital streaming porn.
Yeah.
Their whole lives. They don't know anything different.
Right.
And it's causing a huge change in the brain chemistry of many of us. It's something that we're here to help with.
Yeah. So in terms of the man who's unfaithful, the adulterer, I mean, he goes from porn to that, or how does that work?
Yeah. What happens is the porn use, people, if you're like me, I'll just tell my story. My whole idea of porn use was that this will prevent me from having adultery because it'll just be masturbation and porn. It'll stop there.
Uh-huh.
But what I realized is that, again, lust cannot be controlled. So when I was presented with a situation where a woman kind of came to me and offered herself to me, I couldn't turn it down.
Okay.
So
was she wanting counseling or something like that?
Yeah. I gotten into a situation where I'd helped her and her husband. Her husband was a recovering alcoholic.
Okay.
I got him into treatment. You know, the pastorate is a very dangerous place for anybody that struggles with this, because you deal with people's emotions. And in the minds of women, they're comparing you with their husband. Yeah. And often you come out better because you're more articulate, you're more sensitive, you're more whatever. And
well, they know their husband's, all his weaknesses.
That's
they
right.
don't know yours as
that's
well.
Right. They project a lot of their own needs onto you as if you might be this, you might be the answer, you might. So there's a lot of projection on the female side. So it's really a setup. So the people that say God put me in the ministry to keep me safe, they're misinformed.
Okay.
It's a dangerous place for anybody who struggles with this. I'm giving a talk down at the Alachua County Pastors Association, and they're having a whole series of talks on why people leave ministry, and I'm the last one.
Okay.
And the subject is moral failure.
Okay.
And there's just a lot of people who have moral failures in ministry. It's just the way it is.
Well, the enemy's out there. He's deceiving people. I mean, I talk about it on the show often, and that is stinking thinking. There's a radio play show, or not show, but radio voices playing in your head saying, you know, you're not good enough, you're not smart enough. If you only did this, you'd be fine. If you did that, you know, you're lying or what. I mean, all the garbage that comes into your head.
Yes.
And so, obviously, lustful thinking, you walk into hotel, you walk into a restaurant or whatever, and there's attractive women out there still, right?
Yes.
It doesn't matter what age you are.
And here's the problem is, when you're lusting and when you're acting out, you're thinking that everybody wants sex. That's what you're thinking. There's a lot of lies that go on. We can go into those lies, but they metastasize into cancerous lies, which lead to lust downfalls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what is the greatest thing that someone who, let's say, is a young man who's a millennial, he's been raised on the digital age, you know what I mean? And he's been able to see. When I was a kid, you know, I remember Playboy magazine first came out, and I saw it on this at the newsstand, and I said, what the heck is this? And I'd never seen a woman without her clothes on until a year earlier when a kid had shown me this magazine that was a photography magazine. And I said, holy cow, that woman looks attractive without clothes on. And I didn't know, you know, anything about it. But I was impressed, okay? And then Playboy came out, and then that, because I was raised in the Chicago area, so that's where it got started. But anyway, I was noticing it, and it impacted me as well as anybody else. But how does a young man who has the digital age today, what does he do? How does he prevent this? I guess there are screening devices that can keep you off the internet. Right?
You can do all kinds of things with a computer. I would go to Covenant Eyes and look at all those things. They have blocking and filtering software, accountability software.
Covenant Eyes.
CovenantEyes.com. They're the best source for all of this stuff. But that blocking all that stuff is great, and I think there's a time for that especially, and for the younger you are, the more important it is to block it. But young people can also get around all this stuff. So if you're spending all your time getting around it while you've installed it, then there's a deeper issue, and the deeper issue is the heart. We have to come out into the light. That's why 1 John talks about walking in the light as he is in the light. We have fellowship with one another. We have to get this secret out into the light and into an accountability group, into a place where we can be brutally honest about how we're really doing. And if how we're really doing is constantly addictive behavior, then we're going to need more. We're going to need to get into a 12-step group. We're going to need therapy. We may even need treatment. And we talk to a lot of people who need treatment. And the thing is, if we're not honest with ourselves, we can't get the help we need. Mm-hmm. So we need to come out into the light, into fellowship, tell somebody what we're really doing, and get help. And that's what Living Without Lust is for. Is to provide that help to anybody who wants it, free of charge. We have a hotline. You can call the hotline. It's right on the website, and we'll get you the help you need and direct you in the right path, even if you don't live in Jacksonville, because we have connections elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. So you've dedicated the rest of your life to this whole ministry and movement, and this is what you do. This is it.
This is what I did.
And you're not looking for income or... finances.
Well, we are looking for enough support so that we can keep traveling and providing resources. So we are looking for financial support because unlike the 12-step groups, which don't raise, they're self-supporting typically, we're trying to go upstream and help pastors. And to do that, we need some financial support. People can give right on the website, livingwithoutlust.com, through our PayPal. So we are looking for partners. But we don't have a building. We all operate out of our own homes. We have a board of directors. I do a lot of speaking and one-on-one work. Okay. So that's what really we're trying to do is to help people before they crash, because the cost of crashing is very, very hard.
Right. Does your wife help you with this too as well, or another people?
She is not involved because she has her own stuff.
She's doing her own ministry.
Yeah, okay. So this is not a Jay and Claudia. This is my ministry. She does her own stuff.
Okay. Well, I hope you've heard a lot of this show today. This has been Jay Haig's been with me. He is the founder of Living Without Lust and has had personal experience with all that, starting as a young man with being abused physically and sexually. And he's had a life-changing experience and being a Episcopal priest at one point in time, and also a financial planner for many years, 20 years, you said, right? And now really full-time in the ministry and helping people get their act together and get free of guilt and condemnation and shame and other things that burden you around this whole world of sexual desire and lust. And obviously, you can lust for other things too, but we're really talking more about the sexual lux world. But thank you, Jay. Again, give your phone number again one more time and how to contact you.
People can contact me, 904-635-8546, livingwithoutlust.com. You can sign up for our e-newsletter to stay in touch. Thanks so much for the opportunity, John. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jay. It was great. Thanks again, John Beener with Inspirations 316. See you again tomorrow. God bless you.
Thanks for listening to the Inspiration 316 show with John Beener. Join us each weekday at the same time. If you want to share your testimony, listen to past shows, or get a free book, visit us at our website, www.inspiration316.com.